Okay, hello!
Hello!
Tess has just been sharing her opinions on pianos.
They're too big. No one uses the keys on either end of the piano. They're useless. People only use them to add dramatic effect to a song. And then they go back to playing the nice keys that sound nice.
In the middle. So therefore, pianos are too big.
Yeah.
And that, you heard it here first. Welcome to episode 5 of the ADHD Science Podcast.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. We are going to speak today to Alex Hendry.
Alex Hendry.
From Oxford University. And she's going to talk about basically toddlers looking for sweets.
Yeah. Pretty much.
And she does sound like she's got the cutest experimental protocol known to science.
Oh, absolutely.
100%.
Not even a question.
And we had a really good chat. And I think executive function is such an important aspect of ADHD, and it's not, because it's quite hard to measure, it's not really talked about, and it's not one of the kind of criteria, so therefore it's not really targeted, but perhaps we should. The difficulty is how we target it, and people like Alex, and our next week's guest, little spoiler, are really looking into the things that we can do and on an everyday level to improve executive function.
But more on that later.
Oh, yes, in a week's time. Thank you, Tess. Right, before, no more further ado, we're going to go...
Before no more further ado.
Shush. We're going to talk to Alex Hendry.
Alex Hendry.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello, we are here. It is the third time we've attempted to do this.
We're all about transparency.
We're all about transparency. Well, although I'm not seeing through.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are here with Alex Hendry, Research Fellow at University of Oxford. And that's
all
we've got so far. Yes, thank you, Alex, for bearing with us.
So, when you were doing your research, what kind of questions were you asking? What did you want to find out about?
Okay, so I'm really interested in two things. One, the kind of the overlap between autism and ADHD. What are the kind of things that are common across both conditions? And I'm also interested in finding strengths and difficulties and using strengths to maybe help support children to address some of the difficulties, particularly those shared difficulties that might be experienced by people who are autistic and have ADHD, or who either are autistic or have ADHD.
And what does that mean in practice for you? How do you go about doing that?
Okay, so the kind of the area that I hit upon fairly early in my PhD research was executive functions. So probably you'll be very aware of what executive functions are, but just to kind of break it down for anyone who's not, when we talk about executive functions, we mean kind of those skills that help us plan and work towards goals. So they're kind of, you know, really useful in everyday life. They're the kind of skills that require us to take turns, to wait sometimes, to hold multiple pieces of information in mind, to think flexibly and act flexibly in response to a changing situation. And we kind of lump all of these really complicated and hard skills together under this banner of executive functions. And there was kind of plenty of research suggesting that both autism and ADHD are associated with some differences, often described as difficulties in executive function, but maybe not always difficulties, maybe some strengths as well. And some people kind of have suggested that possibly that might be a genetically influenced link, and actually then that might be a more meaningful thing to study than actually trying to put autistic people in one bucket and a separate bucket of people with ADHD. Because, you know, as you'll know, actually, lots of people who are autistic have ADHD and vice versa. So maybe it makes more sense to think about executive function as this common thing. So that's where I started from. And then I kind of got really interested in understanding, well, how does executive function develop? What does it look like when children are struggling with their executive functions? And what might we do about that?
And to what extent is executive function a single thing?
It's kind of, it's both a single thing and it's many, 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 many lots of different things. So it's a single thing in that anything to do with goal-directed action kind of requires this umbrella of executive functions. And to a certain extent, in the real world, you kind of can't break it down too discreetly because you've just got problems to solve. You don't sit there and go, okay, well, first, I am going to engage my inhibitory control. I'm going to wait and hold off this response. And then I am going to plan. And then I am going to change my response. Of course, you're doing all of those things at the same time. But in some senses, it is one big jumbly mess, particularly in children, perhaps. But at the same time, it does seem to be the case that some people have strengths in one aspect of executive function, like they might be particularly good at waiting, but really struggle holding multiple items in mind. That's my particular area. I have got the worst working memory in the world, particularly vulnerable when I'm tired or stressed, like most people. But actually, my inhibitory control is all right. Other people, they might have kind of difficulties across the board. So that's really interesting in itself, I think. With regards to autism and ADHD, it classically got described that, you know, people who have ADHD might have particular difficulties in inhibitory control and working memory, whereas autism might be classically defined as difficulties with thinking flexibly and responding flexibly. But well, what happens if you have both? What happens if you're just kind of neurodivergent and it's all mixed together? What does that mean for your executive functions?
How would you describe the, what was it you said? It was like inhibiting function. How would you describe that?
Inhibiting. So that's basically stopping doing something. And sometimes we stop doing something and that's the end of it. So I might have a big plate of biscuits in front of me and I'm using my inhibitory control to just eat one and not eat all of them. So the action there is just stop eating all the biscuits. But sometimes we use our inhibitory control. And now I can just not, I'm totally thinking about biscuits. So I'm having to use my inhibitory control to stop thinking about biscuits and trying to...
No, I'm thinking about biscuits.
Yeah, we're all thinking about biscuits now. It's really, really hard. So we use our inhibitory control in our attention as well. That's really important. But sometimes we use our inhibitory control to stop an action and produce a different action. So one example I give is if you're walking through like a massive, long office block or hospital, and you've got a series of doors and they're all pull doors, pull doors, pull doors, and you're walking down this long corridor, and after the fourth or fifth pull door, you hit a push door, instinctively you start to pull it and you have to use your inhibitory control to override that strong, what we call a prepotent or overlearned response to produce a different response.
Mm.
Right. Okay.
That makes sense?
A little bit.
So another example is if you're a tube user, if you live in London. I used to live in London and use an Oyster card, and you get used to kind of getting your Oyster card out and bashing it on the thing. And then sometimes I would get to my place of work and try and use my Oyster card to tap into my office building.
It's just it's a habit thing. Yeah,
it's a habit thing. Exactly. Yeah.
And so how do you study that? What do you actually do to study executive function in children? What are the experiments that you kind of carry out? What does it look like?
So I'm really interested in the littlest children. So my area of interest is 0 to 3-year-olds. So that's challenging for two reasons. One, executive functions are really only just starting to develop in this age group. And two, lots of other skills are only just starting to develop in this age group.
They're very wriggly.
So you've got children who are maybe still learning their language skills, who are learning to control their bodies. So all of the classic tests that were developed for older children and adults, you can't do. You can't get them to sit still and produce snow. And that's in part because of their weak executive functions, right? You need your executive functions to sit still, but then also you've got to be understanding complex instructions and maybe classically you get people to tap different letters on a keyboard. That's not going to fly with a toddler. So we have to be really, really imaginative. And so we've developed, me and my colleagues at the University of Oxford and previously at King's College London, have developed a lot of different tasks. So some of them are object-based, so we play with kind of shape sorter type things where you have to put a thing in one hole and then we move it and you have to put it in a different hole. So it's kind of tapping into the kinds of things that toddlers like to do. Another thing that they like to do is they like to play on touchscreens. So we have a lot of touchscreen games where we play hide and seek and having to remember different kind of routines where you tap on one side and then another, and you have to kind of keep track of where you've tapped to find the reward. And my favourite one, one that I developed as part of my PhD, is called the problem-solving box task. And there the child has to get at three rewards. So we hide these little treats in. We give the child the one treat first, normally a Smartie, but, you know, if their parent doesn't want them to have Smarties, it could be grapes, whatever. We give them a treat and then we say, look, here are three more. Can you get them? And they don't even have to understand that instruction because they can see it. This is a clear box and they can see in there three more Smarties. So pretty much every toddler that you've ever met will be like, Smarties, yes, please. And they will go for it, right? But this is a trick box. So to get at these three different rewards, they have to respond in different ways. So one of the lids lifts, two others are stuck down and they have to pull in different directions. And so what you see is children thinking flexibly, coming up with lots of different responses, having to inhibit, so hold off that response that maybe worked last time, that if the lid lifted, you might expect it to work again. So you have to stop with your lid lifting. And you have to be persistent and persevere when it gets hard and manage your emotions. That's another really important part of executive functions, is managing your frustration when things aren't working well.
So it's knowing when to stop, but it's also knowing when to keep going.
Yes. And so one of the reasons I really like this task is a cool finding from my PhD work was that children who have a family history of ADHD seem to show strengths in this task. So, like, historically, researchers have banged on and on about all the executive function deficits associated with ADHD. And I'm not saying there aren't challenges, right? But consistently, so I've replicated this in two different samples now, we find that children who have a family history of ADHD, so they may or may not go on to develop ADHD themselves, but this group, they are more flexible, they come up with more strategies, and they are more successful as well. So they get at more rewards than their peers who don't have a family history of ADHD.
This is great. I have ADHD, so I'm going to get more Smarties than everyone else.
You deserve exactly. more Smarties than yeah. everybody else. Unfortunately, the rest of your family also have ADHD.
So, so you're competing with them. Yeah.
In the family, 80% of the people are on the same level, and then there's mum.
Yeah, poor mum.
She'll never get the Smarties.
Never gets the Smarties.
She never. Actually, that's literally true. We get sweets and within, this is completely off topic.
It's not completely off topic at all.
Actually, it's not, is it?
No, not at all.
We get like sweets and chocolate into the house. And my poor mum, she's so busy working. She comes downstairs, they're all gone. We've just gotten them all.
Yeah. And but I think this also speaks to another reason that maybe children with ADHD haven't classically done that well or performed the way that researchers might expect them on executive function tasks, is because they weren't super motivated by the task that the researchers came up with. So if you get a child to do a bunch of arbitrary rules and respond in a certain way just because a researcher said so, you know, there's going to be a category of children that go, eh, maybe not.
And I think probably ADHD people and neurodivergent people generally are going to be more likely to be like that. It's often said, and I think it's probably chimes with my experience anyway, that people with ADHD, they need more rewards. I don't want to sort of slip into sort of pop psychology dopamine stuff, but, you know, people with ADHD, we need more immediate, more tangible rewards in order to motivate us, however you want to think about that. So that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then once you are motivated, my goodness, the creativity, the problem solving. So if that's something that we can build upon and, you know, helped, I think it's got kind of a lot of potential there, because it suggests that maybe we've been underrating children who have either a family history of ADHD or ADHD, you know, full stop. But also it gives us an opportunity to think about, well, what can we do to build this child's self-esteem? Can we set up tasks in a way that are motivating and engaging for children so that they do want to succeed at them, and then they do? And so that builds this kind of positive cycle of the child starts to feel good about themselves compared with where they were before, when it's just constantly, oh, you can't sit still, you can't do this and that. So I think it's a much more positive and optimistic way to try and engage with young children.
Okay, so you said that these children are around like three, right?
Yeah. So the PhD work that I was doing was with 2 and 3 year olds. So I find that group difference at both age points. Now the intervention that I'm running, the program called START, that's designed for children who are between 21 months and 27 months. So this real kind of exciting toddler period, because that's when executive functions are really blooming.
Because I was wondering if you thought that possibly some of the differences between the children who don't have ADHD families and the children who do might be because of the way they were raised, or if they're too young for that to have a big effect on them.
Yeah, that's a really
good question. That's such a cool question. Probably a lot of the parents that we speak to would suggest, yes, that's the case. Sometimes parents are like, oh, but, you know, he's like that because he sees me being like that. He's really kind of creative and tries different solutions because he sees that's how I tackle tasks. Well, brilliant. But possibly it's genetic too, also fine. And to a certain extent, as far as the child is concerned, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe all we need to really understand is, what's life like for the child? What strengths do we have to build on? And where might they need extra support? So personally, I'm slightly less interested in why did they get to that point right now? I'm more interested in, given the point that you're at, what can we do to support you to flourish?
So yeah. We don't have to have the nature nurture discussion. Good.
Right?
Good. Let's not have that. What is your intervention?
Right, so it's called START, which stands for, bear with me because I need to take a deep breath for this. So the title in full is Supporting Toddlers with a Family Connection to Autism or ADHD to Develop Strong Attention, Regulation and Thinking Skills. So if you...
That's a stretch. That's a stretch. START!
Exactly, yeah. So it's...
An acronym for pirates.
Sorry, say again.
It's an acronym for pirates.
It's an start. Yeah, I'm Cornish, so I like to put some rolling R's in there. Yeah. So as well as being a short name for a very long title, it's called START because we're trying to start at the beginning. We're starting when executive functions, these thinking, attention, and regulation skills are first starting to emerge, and it's a parent toddler program. So the first kind of principle of START is it must be fun, because parents and toddlers, they don't want to be sat doing, you know, boring learning by rote. That is not going to fly,
especially not neurodivergent.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the second principle of START is it must be inclusive. It must work for neurodivergent people kind of at its broadest. So that means we wanted to develop a program that was going to work for maybe parents who were feeling a bit anxious, children and parents who might have sensory difficulties or differences, and kids who are really, really shy, but also kids who are really, really active. So we've done a few pilots now, and we have absolutely had both sides of that. We've had the kind of the child who needs to spend the first 15 minutes. You're raising your hand. You're the child who runs around the room. Yeah.
No. Pilot studies are mini versions of the study that happen before the big study, so you can
pilot studies. Correct? Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Thank
pilot
you.
Study for the mini version.
Intelligent lay audience.
Yes.
Yeah. So we run. We're kind of on our third kind of pilot. So the first pilot we did, I just kind of went out there with my bag of toys and did a version of the program with what we call a general community sample. So just people who live in a particular area of Oxford. I specifically chose an area of Oxford where there's lots of socioeconomic deprivation, because we know that that is also associated with executive function difficulties. Just to try out these games and to see, do toddlers like it? Because the best feedback that you can get is from a toddler who's looking at you going, no, I don't want to do this activity, then they'll just walk off. So instant feedback. So I did that a few times, and then went through this big long process. It took a year, but it was really, really rewarding, of refining the program with neurodivergent families, particularly mostly neurodivergent parents who themselves are autistic or have ADHD, often raising neurodivergent children, sometimes raising neurotypical children, but then the occasional parent who's neurotypical raising a neurodivergent child. So a real mixture of perspectives. And I kind of got them to pick holes in all the different activities and go, what would we need to change here to make you feel comfortable with this? Are we sending the right message? Does this challenge anything that you feel strongly about? And, you know, one of the great things about working with neurodivergent parents is they'll often be quite
they will tell you.
in a really kind way of this isn't right. So that was fabulous. And then we've since run two more pilot rounds with neurodivergent families from beginning to end. So it's a 12-week program. So in proper pilot one, we ran a 12-week program with, I think, 7 families. And then pilot two, another 12-week program with 6 more families. And now we're at the feasibility trial stage, which is basically running not only the program, but the evaluation of the program from beginning to end. So checking that the measures that we're using to assess executive functions are acceptable to families, that we can get toddlers through it without exhausting them too much, that we pick up useful information about children. So that's where we're at the moment.
And is the idea that you start off not knowing what's going to happen, because you knew what's going to happen, then what's the point of doing the research? People find that hard to get their heads around, but you know what I mean? But the idea is that the hypothesis is that you will find an improvement in some aspects of executive function, overall executive function. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, you're exactly right. So I guess I have kind of two big questions about this trial. My question number one is this okay? Am I really, really sure that I'm doing no harm here? Am I really, really sure that this is acceptable to families, that this fits in with their life, that they're willing to give it a go and feel good about it afterwards? Incredibly important. And then question number two is, does it look like it's actually going to help? Because, you know, we've all got limited time, and often parents if parents have got a family history or a connection to autism or ADHD, they've often got other stuff going on that's really, really important that they're juggling. So, you know, if they're going to give up an hour of their time to go to the sessions plus do these activities at home, we need to be really confident that it might help. So that's exactly the second question that we're asking. Do we see an improvement in children's executive functions as a consequence of being part of this?
You were talking about what this means for the parents and families of children. What does that mean for those people as well as clinicians who are helping to look after these kids?
So what I'm hoping to get to a point with families is that if they've been a part of START, they come away from it, A, feeling good about themselves and their child. So this is a neurodiversity affirming program. So it's about not saying, all right, we're trying to make your child less autistic or less ADHD. It's actually about saying, we're trying to help you recognize the brilliant individuality of your child, notice the extra supports that they need when they need it, and also notice where they're really thriving already so that you can celebrate that with them. So I hope one practical implication is that we've put out into the world a new thing that actually maybe helps families feel better about things. But then the second practical implication that I'm hoping is that we're raising a new generation of children who maybe have slightly less struggles than children who went through.
Yeah, I mean, incremental gains,
didn't get that support. Yeah. So a lot of the parents that were involved in the co-refinement of the program and the first pilots, they were like, oh, I wish this had been there for the older child because they're really struggling now at school. If we can get the children who've been through START to the point where they're not struggling, that they recognise their strengths and their weaknesses and know what supports to ask for, and the parents and the teachers know how to make the environment a little bit comfier so that executive functions aren't always being overloaded, because it's not just about changing the child. That's really another really important thing about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think that's, go on.
This is a shortcut to a process that takes years and years and years of self-acceptance, getting your friends and family and teachers to accept who you are,
yeah.
figuring out your strengths, your weaknesses, and how to, like, oh God, accommodate for these weaknesses. And this just stuff that, like, based on our other podcast where we talk about people's, like, life stories,
yeah,
stuff that takes, like,
seldom
decades. So that is really, really helpful.
So we're hoping to get in there for the toddler so that to start that journey early, but also to help parents who are on that journey, because of course a lot of the parents themselves will be neurodivergent, and we're giving them an opportunity to chat with other neurodivergent parents and go, oh, actually we're not doing so bad, and I've got this expertise, and oh, I've already figured this bit out, and I get to share it with someone else and feel good about that.
Yeah.
What I think is really exciting and different about your approach, genuinely, is that it's partly about improving skills, but it's also just about improving confidence in a funny way, in improving confidence in the and celebrating the strengths and confidence, the strengths of the child. And confidence, if you think about a toddler, is not just the confidence of the toddler, it's actually intimately bound up with the confidence of the parent. I don't think you can talk about one without talking about the other.
Yeah, because when you're a toddler, you basically are your parents.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, in lots of ways, in the way that you interact.
That was incorrect. Please don't keep that in.
Way that you know it is.
No, we're looking at this in psychology. I'm not correct.
You interact with the world as a unit. You are not identical to the person, but you interact with the outside world as a unit. I suppose that's the way of putting it.
So, but that's really, really important, and it's embarrassing. It took me a lot longer to get to that point than you've got to in a 20-minute chat. But during this process of co-refinement with parents, we were talking about, well, how do we know if START is working? Well, of course, we need to look at have we changed things for the parents, and yeah, immediately then parents start going, what now? You're going to start scoring me, judging me? I do not like that. No parent likes to feel judged, and neurodivergent parents, oh my goodness, they've had it kind of rammed down their throat from day one. Yeah. So what we did as a kind of direct consequence of that was we applied for some funding and got some funding to develop new measures of neurodiversity affirming measures of parenting that don't start from the point that there's this one way of good parenting and it looks like neurotypical white middle class parents, that actually start from the point that there are lots of great ways to parent. There are lots of great ways to interact with your child, and there are lots of great ways to feel as a parent. So we've got two measures. One's about what we call parental self-efficacy, but it's confidence, really. It boils down to confidence. So we've got a questionnaire that's been developed with parents to think about, well, what does that mean in the context of neurodiversity? And then we've got this other measure of parent-child interaction that starts from the point of, well, what does it look like to be responsive and attuned when you or your child may or may not be neurodivergent? So should we just rule out eye contact as a prerequisite for, you know, being attuned? Shall we not assume that warmth requires cuddling? And I mean, it was interesting in the focus groups, lots of neurodivergent parents talked about, you know, the importance of a big, deep cuddle for their child. But then other parents were like, no, that's not how I show warmth. I show warmth in a very different way. So we're developing this measure to be much more open to all the wonderful ways that parents can support their children, so that when we're evaluating START, we can see, have we empowered parents in those regards as well?
Yeah. Yeah, that's so exciting, and that's so different to the usual approach. I'm sure you're aware that you'll just drag up some kind of, you know, 1980s era questionnaire and kind of, you know, push it through the parents so that you can kind of get a publication. That's the usual way of doing it, isn't it? Though it is.
Don't ask me.
No, I really wasn't asking you, Tess. I was just I was just non-verbally, I was non-verbally apologising to you for the fact that my gesticulations were getting a little bit wild.
He just fully slapped the computer. He was doing some wide gesture. He just absolutely backhanded the computer.
Totally backhanded the computer. Anyway, so there you go. That's what happens when I get excited. I backhand the computer. What's notable by its absence, and I think this is a great thing, but I wondered if you want to talk about it, is notable by its absence is any mention of diagnosis or prevention or reduction in future diagnosis. We can talk about that a little bit, because
yeah, it's definitely not an accident. We are not trying to make a child less autistic or less have fewer ADHD traits. We are not trying to put children into groups. You know, it's particularly hard at this young age anyway.
They're their own group. I mean, unless you've got a cattle prod, you really can't keep them in one place.
I'm
joking.
I know you are.
So what we do, when we're recruiting families in, we ask about, you know, is there a diagnosis of autism or ADHD? But we also include people who are like, no, I'm not diagnosed, but I'm pretty confident because, you know, if you're neurodivergent. And so we've got some standardized questionnaires, and we have this big disclaimer about how, you know, they are still using the deficit model, but that's not the way we think. It's just those are the measures that we're kind of almost forced to use to be able to develop stuff within this space. So families can come in whether they suspect themselves to be neurodivergent or whether they've got a clinical diagnosis. But also within the study, we are monitoring the children. We do an ADOS, so that's the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. That's the standardised thing that any child would go through if they're on an autism diagnostic pathway. We do kind of ratings of ADHD-like traits, but we're not doing that to go, ooh, have we checked that the numbers have gone down at the end? We're doing that so that we can understand, is START working in different ways for different children? Because if it turned out that actually it wasn't very suitable for children who have extremely high autistic traits, because just the sensory demands of being in a group setting are just too much, we need to know that. So we need to understand our population, but we're not looking to bring those scores down. The other reason it can be quite useful to do this is because you'll know that it's really, really hard for families to get access to diagnosis at the moment. And diagnosis is the gateway to support, unfortunately. So whilst we don't give a clinical diagnosis at the end of the full START trial, what we can do is share the raw scores so that if a child is scoring really high, they can go back to their, GP or health visitor and say, I've got a strong case here, please. Could you support me? Yeah.
I don't know what the average health visitor would make of an ADOS score, but I know exactly what you're saying. They could be pointed in the right direction.
So what do you think is your next question? What are you looking into next?
Oh, I don't know. I think START's going to keep me busy for quite some time. This particular program's going to be running till 2026. So I can't really think more than 3 years ahead. But that said, every kind of step of this project has taken me off in some new directions. I didn't think I was going to start developing new measures of parenting in neurodiversity affirming context. So who knows is the honest answer. I'm so privileged to be able to kind of be changing as a researcher as a consequence of this kind of co-design practice, that it would almost be just too naive of me to think that I might even predict where I'll get to in 3 or 5 years.
I suppose I'd answer that question a slightly different way. If you had a spare researcher, what's the question you haven't got time to research, to look into, that you'd like to send that imaginary free researcher funded by some mysterious
benefactor? You're acting like you didn't write these questions.
Yeah, but I just think in this particular context, it can be asked in a different way. What question would you send that person off to look at?
Yeah, I think if I had unlimited resources, it would be, and unlimited access to families, it would be really interesting to understand more about what is the most useful timing. There's a lot of kind of discussion that earlier is always better. And, you know, I'm an infant and toddler researcher. I kind of am strongly leaning towards that. But do we really have the evidence base to support it? I don't know that we do, because we've tried different things at different time points. So to actually do a neurodiversity affirming intervention to support executive functions at different points in children's development, I think would be, yeah, really enlightening.
I mean, surely there's that thing of the earlier you go, the less developed they already are, so the less likely it is to have a big effect. Does that make any sense?
You can argue it that way.
If you're trying to do this process on a newborn, it's probably not going to be as effective as if you did it on a toddler.
That would be soon, because they've got no executive functions to build upon.
Yeah, exactly.
But equally, it's almost, I'm trying to be fair about this, but it's almost just accepted as an article of faith that the earlier the better in intervention in developmental problems.
I think the earlier, the less harm done.
Possibly, but maybe not. I mean, if you do something very harmful early in life, that can have devastating consequences.
So yeah, if you're restricting them from important other opportunities, yeah. I think the thing about early intervention is that you're getting in there soon enough to be part of a positive cascade of effects. So I used to use in kind of presentations the marble run that my kids used to play with, where, you know, if you change which direction the marble goes in early, that can make a massive difference. It will go off in a completely different direction than, you know, if you just get in there late, there are only a few directions to go in. And because we know that executive functions are important for social skills, for academic skills, for, you know, everything, just getting on a train and getting to your destination, it requires executive functions. Being at school requires executive functions. It kind of makes sense that if you can get those skills as strong as possible, as early as possible, then you have more opportunities to have all these other great outcomes. But just because something makes sense, it doesn't mean we know it to be true. So I would really like to test that out.
Yeah. And of course, you're preventing negative cascades. So
yeah, that's what I was thinking.
With the confidence thing. So the cascade of children who might start school very confident but lose confidence, and I see
and again the parents thing,
like, yeah,
the earlier you get in there, the earlier you can begin to have the parents accept them, so that when they're in really key stages of development, the parents know what to do,
rather than
getting in after these stages of development where the parents have already been maybe a little bit confused or not really know where to turn, and then something might have happened during that time that's really affected how they grow up.
That's
why I was saying the earlier, the less harm done, not because they're going to get like...
Oh, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, just because...
Less harm has been done already.
Yeah.
So we know another area where executive functions are really important is mental health. So, you know, if you're struggling with your executive functions, you're more likely to be anxious, you're more likely to be depressed. And there's lots of reasons for that, partly because you're constantly being criticized by other people and that impacts your self-esteem. But also because we use our executive functions to kind of move past anxious thoughts or depressive thoughts. So again, the thinking is if you can get in there early, then you might circumvent some of those problems. And also, like you say, if you can get in there early and support parents, we know without a shadow of the doubt that parental mental health is super important for children's development. So if we can get parents in a situation where they've developed peer support networks, developed skills and confidence, and have got a whole bunch of tips and techniques up their sleeve, then that ought to improve their mental health and therefore their child's outcomes as well.
And it's good that you picked up that. Sorry, well, I meant to pick up earlier this idea of peer support, because I think it's so powerful for the parents of neurodivergent children. It's something that's absolutely, I mean, fundamental to what we try to do in Lambeth, where I work, is setting up and supporting peer support, because it's the one thing that I always recommend whenever I'm making a diagnosis of any neurodevelopmental condition. It's always peer support is always the one thing that's always a good idea.
Yeah. So something I've not really spoken about yet is that I didn't do this all by myself, right? So I've partnered with a charity called People, P-E-E-P-L-E. And the reason that I've...
You've hidden.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a stronger acronym.
Cutting but true. But the reason that I chose to partner with people is their specific ethos is we do with parents, not to parents. And they start by helping parents recognize for themselves and with each other what they're already doing, which is brilliant. And just that point of recognizing that makes you do more of the good stuff. And it makes you feel better about yourself. And that in turn makes you do more of the good stuff. So I really, really like their ethos. And everything they do is about peer support. It's about learning together through discussion, through play, through having those casual conversations about, oh my God, it was a tough night last night. No one slept. The empathy and the kind of practical problem solving is always going to be better than, you know, a well-meaning so-called expert giving the, you know, the supposed right answer that actually doesn't work for the child in front of you.
Yeah, exactly. And that well-meaning expert hasn't got the time to kind of get to know the family in a way that might give them sort of special insight. I think it's incredibly
powerful.
Are
you the well-meaning expert?
You quite often, yeah. And wow. I kind of turn up and I'm crazy. Like, well, I don't really have the answers. Can you just...
Oh, you poor man.
No, but I mean, I think that's a really good way of starting.
No, genuinely.
You've got to start like that. And because otherwise you end up feeding this kind of dependence on expertise.
And then you've only got a certain time slot.
Yeah.
Where you can help them. And after that, it's really there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's on to them.
It's difficult. It's very, very difficult to kind of get people to feel like they can do their own problem solving and be confident in their solutions, which is why this sort of stuff is really powerful. I really love it. I love the idea of it. Okay, I think we've probably exhausted your kind of kindness, but I just want to ask, you research toddlers trying to get Smarties. Have you actually got the most adorable experiments in history? I mean, is there anything more adorable that we can even think of?
But I would like to point out that quite often toddlers will half eat a Smartie, enjoy it very much, and then put it in my hand. So, you know, prison class.
It's a little bit less adorable.
I've got to be honest, I can think of quite a lot of things cuter than toddlers.
Oh, you're not a big toddler fan.
They're cute, but if you look at a squirrel monkey, I feel like the kind of proportions aren't really there.
Toddler every time.
they're awesome. I love my job. But they are exhausting.
Exactly. Excellent toddler work.
Well, to be honest, I was in Oxford today and they're some of the cutest kids I've ever seen in my life that day.
So there you go. See? Anyway. All right.
But I think I would prefer squirrel monkeys.
Okay. You're going to adopt a family of squirrel monkeys.
Yeah.
Excellent.
We were watching this documentary on Maslow, who did the study on the squirrel monkeys.
Sure.
Almost cried. You know, the one with the... Anyway, fire and the...
Bad. Bad experiment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
they would figure out
if the monkey preferred food or creature comfort, or not creature comfort.
Social interaction.
Comfort. And then they scared the monkey to see which one it would go to, and it went to the comfortable one.
Yeah.
And I've just, when they brought that little creepy monster out to scare the monkey, I just absolutely couldn't deal with it.
There's some really horrible stuff that people have done to monkeys.
Yeah. Anyway,
toddlers and Smarties. Huh? Thank you so much for joining us. I told you before we recorded, sometimes we just start rambling because we're tired. And that's the point at which we have to stop.
Well, it was really lovely chatting with you.
Lovely to speak to you. And maybe you can come back and speak to us again sometime. And you're only local, so who knows? We'll run into each other. Or
but we're not going to tell you where.
No, we're not allowed to tell you where. But you can have a game.
Okay, well, maybe see you in the King's Head some other time.
Yeah. Maybe. All right. All right. Thank you very much. Cheers, bye.
Bye.
Right, great. Chat with Alex.
Just
repeating things that I say in a mocking tone is not humorous, Tess Davey.
I think it is actually humorous. Max Davey.
All right, fine. If you want to talk to us on the podcast, make some suggestions for the next season. I'm sort of on Twitter. I'm slightly taking a rest. At Max Davey.
But you can give it a try.
At ADHD UK Charity, and then at the ADHD UK website, there's a feedback form where we would like to hear what you have to say and what you want to think and talk about.
Yes, we would. And what you want to think and talk about.
Yes, and once again, my words are out of place. It's been a long day, Tess. It's been a long
day.
And
that's all right.
right. So please let us know. I hope you all have a lovely week. And we will speak to you next week.
Bye.